Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, here to help you build and rewire your fitness mindset. I need to take a pause and a break because this podcast is incredible. This is one of these rare podcasts that you'll have seen me if you follow me on other social media platforms, that I would be recommending absolutely every single person who listens to any of my podcasts or follows any of my social media channels that they come back and listen to. And that doesn't happen all the time because sometimes some topics are more applicable to some people than others. But this is one that I think crosses all boundaries because it is talking with somebody who's had a massive inspiration on me over the past year, the past 16, 18 months. A man is Colin O'Brady. Some of you will recognize Colin from the Joe Rogan Experience. He's been on Joe Rogan twice. And his recent book, which is crushing all the bestseller lists, is The Impossible First, From Fire to Ice, Crossing Antarctica Alone. So on top of having set world records in unsupported and human power crossings of Antarctica, speed records for Explorer's Grand Slam and the seven summits, so he's the fastest person to go up all the seven highest peaks, including Mount Everest, he set out to cross Antarctica solo. So over 54 days, he trekked across Antarctica, which is 932 miles, with a 160 kilo sled, which if you just think about that in the conditions of Antarctica, is something that several people have attempted in the past and some have died. A lot of people have quit and haven't been able to do it. And Colin completed that in, I think it was December 2018, I've forgotten the date now, but completed that several months before I did the Arctic, because how I came across Colin first was when I was training and preparing to run 230 kilometers through the Arctic, Colin popped up on the Joe Rogan Experience, and he was one of those accounts and Instagram pages that I followed every single day in the lead up to my Arctic run because of his preparation for Antarctica. He was doing throwbacks on photos, what he was doing, and it was just one of those, he's one of those people that had such a positive impact on me that I couldn't wait to talk to him on the podcast. He's the only book this year that I've ordered on pre-order. So the day it went out on pre-order, I ordered it because I've been dying to read it. I've now got the physical copy, which I've read, and I have the audiobook, which I've listened to because Colin reads it himself. And this is going to be one of my tools in my arsenal. The next time I set a massive challenge for myself, this is going to be the book that I come back to because it just makes you question all the limitations, how you're setting goals, how you're doing and building your mental strength and self-discipline. And all these things that I know connect with a lot of people on the podcast, myself included, this book has so many tools just through Colin telling his story. In this podcast, we talk about Antarctica. We talk about his pivot into the world of extreme challenges. We talk about managing the fear loop and handling negative self-talk and building your mindset so that you are able to set any goal for yourself, relatively speaking. What I love about Colin is he takes that relative approach, similar to what I try and do when I do these ultramarathons, 100-mile ultramarathons, running through the Arctic, running through the Sahara. Colin talks about Antarctica the same way, that his version of Antarctica is somebody else's 5K. And regardless of what goal you set for yourself now, whether it's a fitness goal, whether it's a business goal, whether it's a relationship goal, there's so much in this episode that is hopefully going to resonate with you as much as it resonated with me. This is one that I'm going to go back to and listen to several times. The one thing I will say, and I won't know what this is like until we post-edit, we couldn't get the microphone. I sent Colin a mic before this podcast, but we couldn't get the sound on the microphone to work properly, so we did it without the mic. I think the sound quality is near perfect, but I am a little bit of a perfectionist when it comes to the sound quality, so hopefully it comes as well as when I'm just listening back to it now, it comes out as well. But just if you're wondering why the sound quality might be slightly skewed compared to other podcast guests, that's potentially why. This episode's amazing. Like, I've nothing to say about it except that this is one of my favorite ever podcasts that I've recorded. So without further ado, enjoy today's episode, Colin O'Brady, From Fire to Ice, Crossing Antarctica Alone. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today with my guest, Colin O'Brady. Colin is an explorer and elite endurance athlete who has set multiple world records and is a leading expert on mindset. Among his feats are the world's first solo, unsupported and human-powered crossing of Antarctica, speed records for Explorer's Grand Slam and the Seven Summits, and reaching the highest point in all 50 US states in a record-breaking 21 days. Prior to December 2018, no individual had ever crossed the landmass of Antarctica alone without support and completely human-powered. Yet Colin was determined to do just that, even though 10 years earlier, there was a doubt that he'd ever walk again. His incredible book, The Impossible First, From Fire to Ice, Crossing Antarctica Alone, spans his triumphant recovery from a tragic accident to his gripping 932-mile solo crossing of Antarctica. I am so excited to talk all things endurance, crazy challenges, and mindset in today's podcast. Colin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It's great to be here.
Mate, the pleasure is all mine. One of the ways we connected first was when I was running through the Arctic in February 2019, I'd heard about your story, and it was just one of those stories. I'm like, I can get through the Arctic. I can run 230 kilometers through the Arctic. I'm like, here's Colin doing these crazy challenges. To give a shout out publicly to everybody listening, Colin is one of the reasons that I got through that, just for a complete mindset shift for myself. So thank you for that. But before we dive into your epic adventure and talk about your incredible book, The Impossible First and Antarctica, tell us a little bit about your backstory and kind of what got you into the world of endurance.
Yeah, so I'm American. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. So for those who know that, you know that Pacific Northwest, but it's like north of California and the west coast of the U.S. I was actually born on a hippie commune of all places with a bunch of my mom hanging out, giving birth to me on a futon with some hippies hanging around smoking pot. So I kind of came into the world in a somewhat untraditional way. It was a great place to be raised in the Pacific Northwest. This part of the country, the U.S., is full of, you know, mountains and trails. And my family didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, but, you know, take me outside basically to run around and play. And that's kind of where I, you know, grew my love of sports and certainly adventure. As a kid, I was a swimmer and a soccer player and went on to be a collegiate swimmer in the U.S. At Yale University. So I was kind of an athlete all growing up. Definitely swimming obviously has the endurance components to it. But once I graduated from college, I, we can get into this a little bit, a little more depth, but got into triathlon by way of being severely burned in a fire in Thailand. And kind of the rest is history from there with these endurance projects, bigger ones on top of that, chasing these world records the last 4 or 5 years.
I think this is a nice segue because it kind of talks about your pivot into extreme challenges. But talk to us about that tragic accident. I think you were 22 in Thailand. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So just after graduating from university, I had never really traveled much as a kid. You know, like I said, I didn't have a lot of money growing up, but painted houses every single summer and was, you know, kind of like, you know, I'm going to save up money. One day I want to go see the world a little bit. There was just a piece of me that just felt like I wanted to explore, you know, as many young people do. I know it's probably more common in the UK than the US, but, post-college, you know, took a few $1,000s and bought the cheapest plane ticket I possibly could and to go live in youth hostels and backpackers and, you know, hang out and see the world by myself and meet people and amazing experience all around. I was in Fiji, where actually I met a beautiful girl on a beach who turned out to now be my wife, you know, 13 years later. So that was a win right out the gate. Australia, New Zealand, hitchhiked around, you know, surfing and all that. And then ended up in Thailand. And I don't know if you've been to Thailand, but fire dancing is somewhat common there. And I decided to participate in a fire dancing game of a flaming jump rope, which went terribly wrong for me. I was 22 years old. It was January of 2008. And this flaming rope wrapped around my legs and splattered my entire body with kerosene and lit my body on fire to my neck. Kind of things unfolded from there. Kind of survival mode kicked in, as it would for anyone, I suppose. And luckily, I was near the ocean. So I jumped into the ocean to extinguish the flames, which ultimately saved my life, but not before about 25% of my body was severely burned, predominantly my legs and feet. And I was on this tiny little island, you know, didn't have, proper medical facilities. I had like a moped ride down a dirt path to this one room nursing station. And eventually over the next 8 days and kind of these rickety makeshift small hospitals, I underwent 8 surgeries. Not a place you want to be having a surgery. Basically, there's like a cat running around my bed and across my chest in this ICU. I mean, it was a pretty rough set of circumstances. And of course, the physical trauma was immense, but the mental side was even worse when, you know, 4 or 5 days in this ordeal, this Thai doctor walks into my you know, hospital room, and he looks me in the eye and he says, "Hey, Colin, you know, you'll probably never walk again normally. The damage here to your ligaments, your knees, your ankles, et cetera, is so severe that you're never going to, you know, regain the full mobility of your legs." And I remember that moment so vividly. You know, obviously the pain had been searing, but, you know, as a lifelong athlete at this point, someone who thought of himself as, you know, a collegiate athlete, swimmer, loved to move my body, it was just the worst, you know, diagnosis possible. And it nearly broke me, to be honest. But fortunately, there's kind of a savior or a hero of this story, which is my incredible mother. You know, she came over to Thailand and ended up sitting with me. Eventually, I got life flighted to Bangkok, and, you know, she spent about a month or so with me in the Thai hospital. And one of the biggest turning points in my life, which really kind of segues into the rest of this conversation, is, you know, she looks at me and I know now that she's crying and pleading with the doctors in the hallways for good news. Come on, tell me that the diagnosis is wrong, you know, this. But they were like not giving it to her. And she was afraid. She was crying. She was full of fear. But the probably biggest moment of my life, she never showed me her own fear. She came into my hospital room every single day with this huge smile on her face and this huge kind of air of positivity, you know, forcing me to shift my mindset, saying like, "Look, Colin, this is not over. Like this, your life is not over. You know, let's set a goal." And I had been an athlete for a long time. So I closed my eyes and I said, "Mom, my dream was to one day complete a triathlon." Which is not something I'd ever done in my entire life before. I've been a swimmer, like I said, but never biked or run really. And instead of her being like, "I mean, look at your legs. I said set a goal, but something more realistic." She didn't do that at all. She was like, "Great, you're going to race a triathlon one day. I can already see you crossing the finish line." And it's this interesting moment when I look back on it, because it would have been so easy to lean into the fear, the vulnerability, the doctor's diagnosis. But I've come to realize that as humans, we all have these reservoirs of untapped potential to achieve extraordinary things, particularly when we shift our minds towards these positive outcomes. And so, you know, I'll digress from this long story, but basically, finally, I did get released from the hospital. I couldn't walk still. I was carried on and off the plane. I was placed in a wheelchair, finally flew back to Portland, Oregon, to my mom's house. And my mother kept at me for the next year and a half, you know, literally teaching me how to walk again, one step at a time. It was a very long road to recovery, but eventually, 18 months after being burned in this fire, I signed up for the Chicago Triathlon to, you know, kind of honor this goal I had set, bandaged and bruised in this Thai hospital. And to my complete and utter surprise, not only did I finish the triathlon, which was my goal, but I actually ended up winning the entire Chicago triathlon, placing first out of, you know, 4,000 or so other participants on the day. And it was obviously, you know, the win was great, but it was more so this defining moment in my life, which showed me, which has continued to teach me over time, which is why the subtitle of my book is From Fire to Ice. Obviously, I burned myself in this fire, and I wouldn't wish the pain of that on my worst, worst, worst enemy. But my mother taught me one of life's most valuable lessons, which is if we can push through the darkness and we can shift our mind towards these positive outcomes and work towards our goals and manifest them and believe in them and visualize them every step of the day, no matter what it is, we are capable of it. And life gets hard. I hope no one out there has to be severely burned in a fire to learn this lesson, but we all know hardship. We all know setbacks. We all know, like you said, running in the Arctic, the fear and the doubt and the things that creep up on us. But there are tools that we have within ourselves, each and every person in our minds, to shift it towards the positive and ultimately achieve our goals on the other side of setback and hardship.
Oh, I can see where your mental strength comes from. Like, your mother sounds like an incredible person. Can you tell me about your pivot into extreme challenges then? Because you had this progressive build from triathlon, and then we're going to get into the Arctic. But what did the transition look like from normal, quote unquote, normal sport to extreme challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was, you know, after being burned this fire and, you know, winning this triathlon, so I have an economics degree, thought I was going to work, you know, on, you know, Wall Street or some sort of financial career, which is why I was actually in Chicago, because I started out doing that for a little while as I was recovering from the burn accident and training for the triathlon. But when I ended up winning this triathlon, you know, there's this guy named Mr. Gelber, Brian Gelber, who's in kind of my network of people I knew in finance, very successful businessman. he heard this story and he was like, this is incredible. And he signed on to be my first sponsor. So gave me the opportunity, although not lucrative at all, like a traditional job, he gave me enough money to basically train triathlon full time. So I moved to Australia and ended up racing triathlon professionally for the next 6 or 7 years, all over the world, which was, you know, an incredible experience for sure. Certainly, you know, not as, like I said, lucrative as a traditional career path, but for me, it was all about craving the experience. It was all about, you know, kind of finding out the inner workings of my body, soul, mind, you know, wanting more than anything to tap into the depths of my own potential. And so I was able to do that through racing triathlon professionally for, like I said, 6 or 7 years from 2009 through the end of 2015. And then kind of, you know, in the last couple of years of triathlon racing, my wife and I, she'd been traveling with me, kind of supporting me the entire time I was racing. And we kind of started to dream up, you know, what do we want to do next? You know, what do we really care about? And I was like, look, I still want to push my body as an athlete, but we kind of got like, you know, what are the biggest dream that we could dream up? And I'm sure you've talked about this on the podcast. I have no doubt, knowing you a little bit, but I'm sure you're a big believer in growth mindset, which certainly I am as well. You know, this concept that even if we don't have the skills in any given moment to achieve something, we believe that we can grow and evolve and adapt and learn the skills necessary. So Jenna and I, you know, we call it, you know, we talk about it in the book, you know, from whiteboard into reality. We, you know, we don't have anything in our, you know, one bedroom apartment. We've got a whiteboard out. We're like, let's just, what's the biggest goal we could dream up in endurance? Also, we want to do something to impact people in a positive way, so really share whatever we did with the world in a way that had positive impact around health and wellness and inspiring young people to get outside and move their bodies. And so we wanted to start a nonprofit to do that. But the goal we wrote on the whiteboard was something called the Explorers Grand Slam. So to see if I could set the world record for something called the Explorers Grand Slam, which is to climb the tallest mountain on each of the 7 continents. So that's the 7 summits plus complete expeditions across the last degree of latitude to both the North and South poles. And, you know, fewer than 50 people in history had ever done that. But no one had really ever tried to do it just back to back to back, not taking any breaks. So that's, you know, climbing Mount Everest, that's climbing Denali, that's Kilimanjaro, that's Mount Elbert, you know, that's all the tallest mountain on each of the continents, back to back to back, no rest breaks. And it's a too long of a story to share here, but how we built and created, I share it in the book. And it's like from nothing. Like, we have no idea what we're doing. We need to raise all this money to do it. I've climbed some mountains, but I'm not like some, you know, legendary mountaineer at this point. And so I need to, you know, build those skills. But it's that growth mindset that's actually saying, we don't know what we're doing. We don't have the resources to do it. Every single thing, every person around us, people that love us are telling like, hey, like, that's a cool idea, but like, how the hell are you ever going to pull that off? Like, you don't, you know, really know about all these things. And it was a long process, but it was a process that we committed to day in, day out for a couple of years. And ultimately, I was successful in setting that record, completing the Explorers Grand Slam in 139 days. And even more so, you know, from nothing and no platform, building a big enough platform that actually had significant impact, where we're able to launch our nonprofit. And ultimately, our nonprofit over the last 4 or 5 years has impacted, you know, millions of students around the world through the programs we've been able to build off of this platform. So I'm really extremely proud of that. But it really comes down to any person out there listening. We all have ideas. We all have goals. I know that. I know if you're listening to this podcast, you know, you've probably set yourself some pretty big goals. But you've also probably looked at some other big challenges in your life. And it could be anything. It doesn't have to be endurance sports. But I know that's a key focus here. But it could be business. It could be music. It could be art. It could be anything. But we've all had that moment of setting a big goal and then kind of in the quiet space in our mind going like, maybe that's not for me, or maybe that's too hard, or you know what, you know, I don't have the skills or the resources to do that. But the story and the why I wanted to write the book the way that I did is not to, you know, just tell my story, but hopefully inspire anyone who sets this book down, The Impossible First, to realize that, you know, I don't have any special set of skills that has allowed me to achieve what I've done. The only thing I have is what we all have, what I call the most important muscle, the 6 inches between our ears, this belief in yourself, this growth mindset that you can set these massive goals, put it on the whiteboard, and through a series of processes of committing to it, actually turn those goals on the whiteboard into reality. And that's really the thematic story of the entire book, is to really guide people through their own process of being able to do that by showing the process that me, myself, and my wife have gone through to achieve these things.
Yeah, your book, we said it just before we went on air, but I'm going to repeat it for everybody listening. There's a handful of books in my life that I have a physical copy, read the physical copy, and then get the audio book as well, because I'm like, I'm going to come back to the physical copy over and over again, and I want to listen to it on audio. It's one of those books that, hand on heart, it makes you question every limitation you set for yourself. Like, you're setting goals and showing your processes and how you do it. And I remember reading this going, I need to set bigger goals. Like, I remember that was the message I was taking reading through. Like, and again, the only person I can compare it to, and this may sound like a weird comparison, but like, I think of you a little bit like the Elon Musk of endurance. I'm like the person that sees these bigger goals, sets them, does them, which segues perfectly into the next thing I want to talk about. Tell us about dragging a 375-pound sled across Antarctica and how... I'm not even sure where to start with this because I've got so many questions, but tell us a little bit about how you prepared for that event and then we'll dive into it a little bit more.
Yeah, so, you know, after the Explorers Grand Slam, you know, Jenna and I were proud that we were able to pull that off. And, you know, she basically builds and plans all the logistics and sponsorships and, you know, she's quite active and savvy herself in the mountains, but in generally she's the one, you know, in the background, you know, coming up with all these ideas or helping facilitate them. And I'm the one out there climbing the mountains, but we do it all together. It's really a team effort, even though, you know, sometimes people think it's just me. It's certainly not just me. I couldn't do it without my wife. She's incredible. And she's dedicated her whole life to this as well. But, you know, after the Explorers Grand Slam, we kind of went back to the whiteboard and was kind of like, okay, like, what is the next, like you said, what's the next massive goal? What's the next sort of curiosity that we have? And I had been in Antarctica for the Explorers Grand Slam because I climbed Mount Vincent, the tallest mountain in Antarctica, and did a much smaller expedition to the South Pole as part of the Explorers Grand Slam. And I was fascinated by Antarctica and the history of it. And during that period of time, I had, you know, found out that there was this still kind of, you know, unconquered world first, which was, as you mentioned in the introduction, a solo crossing. So that's completely alone, but something that's called unsupported and unassisted, or unsupported and completely human powered. So that means crossing the landmass of Antarctica. Unsupported means no use of resupply. So no one's, you know, dropping off extra food or supplies for you. So you have to take everything with you from the beginning, and there's no resupply. So that meant, you know, trying to get enough food and fuel in my sled to not run out. And that meant I started out with about 375-pound sled or 160-kilogram sled, incredibly, incredibly heavy. You could barely move it at first. And there's some funny stories about that, as you know, from reading the book. But and then unassisted. You know, people have crossed the continent of Antarctica in a few different ways, one of which, a really amazing pioneering crossing that happened in 1997, a guy named Borge Alsen, a Norwegian guy, made a solo crossing, unsupported, so no resupplies, but he used these two large kites to propel him forwards and actually went a much further distance than I ultimately covered. It's an amazing, amazingly pioneering expedition, but what separates his expedition from mine is that he was using kites to propel him. So on one, you know, one day, for example, he went 125 miles in a single day using these huge kites to kind of pull him along, whereas I'm just out there kind of mano-a-mano pulling very slowly my 375-pound sled, completely human-powered. So that world first, you know, had never been done, although it had been attempted by several people in preceding years. One guy, unfortunately, a British guy by the name of Henry Worsley, you may have heard of him, he passed away attempting this expedition about 100 miles away from finishing it. And another British guy named Ben Saunders made a very valiant attempt but ran low on food and supplies, kind of misjudging the calculations there, and had to be picked up and in his expedition. So there's a lot of people, you know, these predominant people or other people who have tried or talked about trying this expedition who had failed in various ways. And, you know, I, you know, set out to see if I could do it. But Jenna and I, and the name of the book is The Impossible First, but it's also the name of our expedition when we were planning it. And, you know, it's important for me to note this because we called it The Impossible First, not as some sort of, you know, arrogant or cocky thing to be like, oh, some people say it's impossible or some people have failed and, you know, I think I can be the first one to do it. It was actually the opposite. We called it that because we said this might actually be impossible. Amazing people have tried this and failed. You know, who am I to think that I could necessarily pull it off? But rather than get caught in that doubt or that fear loop like we just talked about in our mind, saying, you know what, this one might be too far, it might be too far out of reach, we call it The Impossible First to say, you know what, when daring to dream impossible things, you might succeed, you might fail. In this case, spoiler alert, I did make it, but had I failed in trying to do it, the value was the same. In stepping so far outside of the comfort zone, that is where we grow. And that's why I encourage people. I certainly don't, I look up to Elon Musk as an extreme, extreme example of this. And it's very kind of you to draw the comparison. I'm not sure I fully agree. Very humbling for you to say that. But someone like him, who's just dreaming up what seems to the rest of the world, these crazy ideas, let's go colonize Mars. Like, people are like, come on, man, like, that's impossible. But look at all the technology and innovation and creativity that's come out of him setting such an ambitious goal and pouring so many resources into it. It's extraordinary. And so this project was, you know, in my much smaller world and universe, the same thing, to say, hey, you know, this is a extremely hard challenge. There's a million ways in which it can fail, but I'm committed to trying and training for it. And so for the next, you know, year over the course of 2018, I dedicated my entire life to training up for the process of what would be to pull a 375-pound sled alone, 932 miles, you know, in average temperature, minus 25, minus 30 degrees, oftentimes wind chill of minus 60, minus 70 degrees, day after day after day, to try to complete this crossing that no one had ever done before.
Talk about the training. I know you added about 20 pounds of muscle beforehand to kind of help, because you were very aware that you were going to lose a lot of weight over this entire event. Talk about what your training looked like in advance. And then we might even transition into what your strength coach, Mike McCastle, did, because there's some great stories in the book about your actual training. But what did it look like, say, the year beforehand preceding? And then you can kind of go into more detail on that too.
Yeah, 100%. I got to shout out Mike McCastle. I'll get into that in a second. But with your guys' focus on training and stuff, he's an absolute legend. So I'll bring him up in a second. But yeah, basically, it's an interesting thing. So when you're setting a world record, if you think of an Olympic athlete, or even what I had done with the Explorers Grand Slam, a world record, you know, you're doing something faster than someone has ever done before, generally. But there's a playbook. You know, you can, if you're, say, let's say you were going to try to run the 100 meters in the, well, Tokyo Olympics just got delayed a year, but say you're gearing up for that, you know, you can look at someone like a Usain Bolt. Maybe you don't know exactly what his training protocols are, but a lot of people have trained for that same event before. So there's a lot of kind of different theories or ideas about this. But when you're doing a world first, in this case, something that had never been done before and only been attempted by a few other people, there's no playbook, right, for training. There's no like, oh, well, let me talk to the guy who successfully completed this and figure out what he did. And so it's an interesting kind of white space of training, particularly myself, not someone who is super experienced in polar travel in general, to actually kind of have to problem solve this. Without, you know, there's no YouTube tutorial or, you know, strength coach who knows exactly, you know, all the different components and have researched this. It's like kind of, you know, drawing on a little bit of intuition and this. But one thing we did know for sure is that I could not carry enough calories in my sled to replenish the calories that I would be burning. So we figured I was going to burn about 10,000 calories per day, and I could only actually carry about 7,000 calories. And I work with this company, Standard Process, you know, kind of side note, but they created this custom nutrition for me called Colin Bars, which are basically, you know, fully plant-based coconut oil, nut seeds. They're an incredible sponsor of mine. They spent about a year in a lab, you know, testing my body, testing this food, and coming up with what they thought was the best calorie-dense food solution for me. And it was amazing. Like, it was absolutely incredible. It was rocket fuel for me. And based on, like I said, some of the smartest minds coming together to build and develop this food that met all the requirements of my needs. But still, even with that, I couldn't actually physically drag enough of it to fully replenish my calories, which meant I was going to be running about a 3,000 calorie deficit all day, every single day. And which, of course, you know, very plain and simple, the math of that means I'm going to lose a ton of weight. And so I went in the gym to put on about 20 pounds or so of muscle and a little bit of fat to give me a little bit of cushion. By the end, you know, my ribs and hips were all sticking out. So I did end up losing a ton of weight. But it's probably a good segue to Mike McCastle, because during this training phase and trying to figure this out, even based on all of my experience as a professional athlete, there was no clear answer to this. And I got introduced to this guy named Mike McCastle, incredible human being. If you look him up, he is an incredible badass. Give him a follow on Instagram or something. But he himself has done, let's see, he has set the world record for 5,806 pull-ups in 22 hours wearing a 30-pound weight vest. Let me just let that set in for a second. How many pull-ups can you do, Brian? I mean, I can do like I can do like 10.
Nowhere near that. Not even a, yeah, like, it's just unfathomable. Because he beat David Goggins' world record, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. So he broke David Goggins' record. And I believe maybe some other people have done more since then, but whatever. It was a few years ago. He also, 5,800. I mean, it's insane. You know, he also has pulled a F-250 truck, you know, a huge pickup truck, 20 miles across Death Valley, like pulling himself in a harness. The car's in neutral and he's just dragging a huge truck by himself. I mean, this guy has done these incredible feats of endurance. So, and he's also an incredible trainer. So when I met him, we were just, you know, a kindred spirit straight away. And like I said, this guy's pulled an F-250 truck 20 miles across Death Valley. I'm trying to figure out how to pull this heavy ass sled really far. It's like, well, hey, this guy might know a thing or two about this. And he turned out, he's one of my, you know, closest friends and confidants. He's helped me train for this. And now I've done a couple other records since Antarctica Crossing he helped me train for as well. What's amazing about his approach is that he has been said, hey, there's no playbook for this, so we got to design the playbook. And it's kind of like a sharing, a mind share. You know, I know a lot of things, he knows a lot of things, we're kind of, you know, collaborating. But in my training phase, he came up with these amazing things. And at times I was like, what the hell are you doing? But, you know, one example I write about in the book, so he's got me one day doing this strength circuit. So, you know, it's push-ups and it's squats and it's sit-ups and, you know, all the type of things that you might, you know, body weight exercises, some weighted stuff. And we're going through a circuit. And then all of a sudden, he pulls out these two buckets of ice. And he has me put my hands in these buckets of ice and do a plank. And so now I've got my hands in these buckets of ice doing a plank for a minute or so. And he's like, okay, now get out of the plank position. My, you know, my heart rate's jacked up from the entire circuit. Now my hands are completely frozen. And he has me do a wall sit. Now I'm sitting against the wall doing a wall sit. And he hands me a weight plate and puts it on my legs. And he's like, okay, you have to hold this wall sit. But then out of nowhere, he hands me a stack of Legos and a little instruction manual. And he says, oh, sorry, my feet are in the ice buckets now. So my feet are in the ice buckets. I'm in a weighted seat. My hands are frozen from just coming out of the ice buckets. And he goes, you can't take your feet out of the ice bucket until you solve this Lego problem with your frozen hands. And it sounds like absolutely ridiculous. I'm like, what the hell are we doing? Like, this is crazy. My feet are frozen. My hands are frozen. Like, my heart rate's jacked up. My mind's foggy from this hard workout. And he says, it is going to be life or death for you out in Antarctica if you can tie knots, if you can function with high mental acuity at the same time as your body being so physically taxed under this extreme, extreme cold and frozen of your extremities. And obviously there's no way to simulate, you know, being alone in Antarctica for how long, but this was his way of simulating it. And at the time, you know, I was like, wow, this is crazy. This is some intense, you know, workout that we're doing here, but it ultimately saved my life. You know, I won't give away too much of the book, but as you know, literally the first few pages of the book, the prologue of the book, I make a mistake. I'm in a massive storm. The wind is blowing wild. And if I don't secure my tent properly, it'll blow away. I'm alone in Antarctica in the middle of a windstorm with no shelter. You know, basically very, very dire set of circumstances there. And sure enough, you know, on the day 40 something, my mind, my body, my heart, I'm just exhausted. And I make a mistake tying one of these knots and my tent nearly flies away from me. And I kind of see my life flash before my eyes in this moment. That's how the book opened. That training with Mike every single day when I was out there, when we were doing it in the gym, I didn't question it, but I was like, this is bizarre. But when I was out there, I realized he wasn't just training my body. He was training my body. He was training my mind. He was training my dexterity. He was training the intensity of these moments. And so he came up, that's just one example, but he came up with all these really, really, really creative ways to simulate the intensity of body, mind, spirit in the middle of this Antarctica crossing, and it made all the difference. I mean, he is an incredible coach, and I owe a lot of the success of this project to his ingenuity and creativity.
This is going to sound so peculiar for someone that's crossed Antarctica and has some incredible pictures in the book, but my favorite photo from the book is you doing a wall sit with your feet in ice doing the Lego puzzle. I'm like, that's just the most amazing photo ever. Let's jump into Antarctica, and as you said, we won't go through it in specifics, because I very rarely, when someone comes on the podcast, I'm going to just give a hard right hook to people, go read this book. Like, it doesn't matter who you are, you are going to get something from it. It's just one of those rare reads where you're going to get either how to set goals, how to pass, blow through limitations, how to make yourself mentally tougher, how to build self-discipline. Like, they're all just some of the messages that I got from it. So I highly recommend everybody pick it up. But I'm curious, instead of jumping into obviously the whole story, talk about the lowest point. What was the lowest point in the entire, in all of the days that you were out there? Does any jump to mind? I know there were several and it was obviously up and down, but what does any singular low point jump out to mind when I say that?
Yeah, I mean, look, and I, again, this doesn't spoil the book because I think most people know when they pick up the book that I complete the crossing and I make it. But to say that I got across 932 miles in 54 days by myself without facing some immense hardships would be, you know, to undervalue the whole experience. Most of the time, it was devastatingly challenging. And you know, there's so many moments. I'll pick one or two to expound on. Gosh, and you know, to me, and the way that I write the book, just to kind of fill in a little bit as I kind of came through this thought is, you know, the book covers the 54 days in Antarctica, as you know, having read the book. But because I'm alone and I'm in my own head, doubts, fears, all the, you know, the high moments, the low moments, I'm also in my mind, and it reflects the book, the way it's written, reflects the way my experience was in Antarctica, which is I'm flashing back to all these childhood memories and kind of all the things that got me to there. And so the book reads as kind of this braided memoir of, on one hand, you're hearing the experience of my time in Antarctica, but as you know, it's flashing back to all these key moments in my life that I'm kind of reliving on the ice. And I bring that up because I say being in Antarctica alone for that long, it's like throwing a massive party and all your angels and demons are invited. So yes, there's some good moments of bliss, and you're kind of hitting flow, and you know, there are some beautiful moments, we can talk about that. But there are some deep, dark moments, and you can't hide from your own thoughts out there. It's 24 hours of daylight. It's brutally cold, minus 25, minus 30 on an average day. I'm out there pulling my sled 12 hours a day. The amount of times that I got in negative headspace and deep fear loops and trying to pull myself out of that is rough. You know, I think that God, there's so many low moments that I could go through, but I, you know, one that comes to mind for sure is I just passed the South Pole, which was kind of 2/3 of the way, and I was into the, you know, day 40 or 42 at this point. And you know, Jenna, I have a satellite phone, and so some of the dialogue in the book is my wife and I talking over the satellite phone. She's kind of my one outside contact with the world, and she's sort of managing my mental and physical, you know, sort of strength out there. And my supplies are running low. And in fact, this guy who had attempted the crossing the year before me, Ben Saunders, he had the same amount of food when he arrived at the South Pole that I had, but he had looked at his sled and he has a lot more experience than I do. And he said, you know what, I don't have enough supplies to make it to the end. I'm going to call and get picked up. And that was a really kind of wise decision. Now, I looked down at my supply of food with the exact same amount of days, about, you know, 14, 15 days of food at that point, and realized I'm going to give it a shot. And so I have this phone call with Jenna, and I'm there in my tent, and I'm kind of like, oh, I've made it. I'm trying to really stay positive, but I'm looking down at my body and my hips are sticking out. My ribs are sticking out. I'm like having trouble just sitting up. I'm like lightheaded from being so starving. And actually my wristwatch at this point that I've had on my wrist the entire time is starting to slip around on my wrist, because it's weird to say, but even my wrists were losing weight. You don't expect your wrists to lose weight, but I'm just losing weight every which way I possibly can. And I get on the phone with her, and she kind of has this harsh conversation with me, not harsh, but honest, I guess. And she's like, Colin, like, you are going to run out of food out there unless you start eating even less food. And I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, like, I'm doing these calculations. She's got this spreadsheet back home. And she realizes that I was eating 7,000 calories per day, burning 10,000, and I'm starving at this point. And she basically has to say to me over the sat phone, you need to rearrange your bags of food and need to eat only about, you know, 5,500. So I'm like, you know, 40 some days starving out in the middle of my tent to then be told, and I know she's right. It's not like I'm second guessing her. I know that she's right. And she's just telling me, you know, Colin, I love you, but if you want to keep pushing and you want to keep pushing the edges of this, you now have to reduce down to, you know, basically a 4,000 or 5,000 calorie deficit. And I'm pulling my sled 12 hours a day. And she goes, that's your only hope of finishing this thing. And again, there's so many low moments, and I could go on and on about low moments, but that feeling, that sinking feeling of looking at these small bags of food in my tent that aren't even sustaining me and going, I have to eat even less now. You know, it sounds crazy that 5,000 calories would be a starvation diet, but when you're doing what I'm doing out there, it most certainly is. and to just have that sinking feeling. It just kind of, I think that that is the root of, you know, kind of human survival of food and calories. And, you know, nothing else matters to me at this point, and realizing the suffering that I'm going to have to go through to try to attempt this thing. And I just break in that moment. I'm crying my eyes out. There's several times across this. There's one chapter of this book that's actually called Frozen Tears, because you know what happens when you start crying and it's minus 25, minus 30 degrees outside? Well, the tears, it turns out, they actually freeze to your face, which is an all around pathetic feeling. So anyways, that's one little anecdote I'll share, but there's so many low moments and challenges. But of course, you know, I'm a big believer that in overcoming these challenges on the other side, it's ultimately where the strength and perseverance, you know, and the character building moments come from. But in those moments, being told that over the satellite phone, like, hey, I know you're already starving, and hey, I know you're emotionally and physically completely falling apart at the seams. Well, the only way for you to do this is to make it even worse for yourself. Stop eating that food. It's just like broken, you know.
That's like, it's the most primitive of things. It's like basic survival, that you don't have enough food. Your body is literally eating itself. I'm really curious, and I've been dying to ask you this since we set up the podcast. How do you mentioned negative headspace. How do you handle that kind of self-talk or that kind of internal dialogue, especially when it shifts to that negative side and negative state? How do you knock yourself out of that? Or what does just your internal dialogue look like with yourself?
Yeah, you know, I think to me, you know, it's been often asked, you know, was this more of a physical challenge or was this a mental challenge? There's no doubt I couldn't have done it without Mike McCastle, the physical preparation, putting on 20 pounds, trying to figure out how to pull a 375 pound sled. I mean, these were hard physical challenges, obviously, but that pales in comparison to the mental challenge of this. And I said it earlier on the podcast, but I'm a big believer, so I'll repeat it, which is the most important muscle that any of us has is the 6 inches between our ears. It's the headspace, it's the mindset. And for me, I won't digress too long here, but the process for me of preparing my mind was the most significant key. And I'll get into how I shift from that, you know, kind of fear loop. But one of the biggest things for me has been my meditation practice. And, you know, 10 years ago, or I guess 12 years ago, something like that, at this point in my life, I was introduced to Vipassana meditation, which is these 10-day silent meditation retreats. 10 days, no reading, no writing, no eye contact, and 10 days of complete solitude and meditation. I'd never meditated a minute before in my life before I went to my first one, but I did it when I was racing triathlon to try to strengthen and sharpen my mind. And just the same way that if you want to get bigger and stronger, you got to lift weights in the gym and do bench press or, you know, whatever that is. To get your mind stronger, it's not just saying, I want to have a stronger mind. It's you need to take your mind to the mental gym every single day to sharpen it and to strengthen it. And for me, this meditation practice has been my avenue for doing it, not just the 10 days, which are a deep immersive experience into, you know, into meditation, which, by the way, they're completely free to go. There's centers all over the country, or sorry, all over the world, 250 centers all over the world. I don't get any, like, you know, credit for sharing this. I just think it's an amazing tool. So if you ever want to check it out, it's Dhamma, DHAMMA.org. Find a center, take the 10 days. You will not be sorry. It was the best return on investment you'll ever spend. And like I said, it doesn't cost you anything other than 10 days of your life, which you'll be grateful for spending. But whatever it is, finding that mindset, that practice to sharpen the mind has been key for me. And that's not to say I don't have the darkness. It's not to say I don't have the fear. I don't have the doubt. I don't have the breakdowns. Clearly, I just exemplify, if you're alone, sitting in my tent, crying, falling apart. But that mental training over the years has also prepared me to reorient my mind. And, you know, certainly a mantra, there's a couple mantras that have been really powerful for me. And one comes from that meditation practice, which of course has been used for thousands and thousands of years, certainly not my own mantra, but it's this too shall pass. This too shall pass. Realizing in these dark moments, we all know that feeling, whether you're running a marathon or a race or a 5K and your heart rate is pounding out of your chest, you think to yourself, I can't take this any longer. But remembering that that moment is actually fleeting, that this too shall pass. When I'm alone in my tent and I'm starving on food and the wind is blowing outside and I'm afraid and I'm scared and I don't know if I want to go back out there and pull my sled another minute, let alone weeks on a time, I remind myself, the wind's gonna die down at some point. This storm can't last forever. The physical storm, but also the storm of my mind can't last. So this too shall pass. This too shall pass. Remembering the impermanence of all, both the highs and the lows are impermanent. And that has been very powerful for me in some of my darkest moments, for sure. Another one, in terms of this came just out of Antarctica, which really reoriented me in a positive way. As you know from reading the book, I struggled right out of the gate. Right out of the gate. Day one, hour one, minute one, I almost couldn't pull my sled and I broke down. I was like, oh my God. And I don't think we'll go too far into this in this podcast, but as you know, this actually was a race. It turned into a race. Not only was I out there alone, but another guy was attempting the crossing at the same time. And so we were both doing it alone, but also ended up in this crazy head-to-head battle. And you know, he seems to be having no problem on the first day and I can't pull my sled and it nearly breaks me. And I wake up this first morning in my tent. I'm all alone after having the worst day ever and actually thinking that I might have to quit day one. How embarrassing is that to tell my family, friends, the world, I'm going to attempt this thing that no one's ever done. Like I said, I called it the impossible first and I figured I might fail at some point, but I didn't picture myself failing on day one. I thought maybe day 30 or day 40, I'd give it at least a good effort. And day one, I'm thinking, I don't know if I can pull this sled 1 foot further. It was just so heavy. And I wake up that first morning and my mind goes to that negative place, the place your question came from, fear, doubt, self-doubt, all the negative self-talk is pouring into my brain as my alarm goes off. And I think to myself, if I stay in this headspace, I'm done. I'm finished. And so I actually sit straight up in my tent and I yell at the top of my lungs, it kind of sounds silly, but out loud to myself into the emptiness and vastness of a white nothingness of Antarctica, I yell, Colin, you are strong, you are capable. You are strong, you are capable. And at first, I don't believe a word that I'm saying, but I'm just trying to get a positive affirmation going because I am a firm believer. Hear this, we are the stories that we tell ourselves. I'll say it again. We are the stories that we tell ourselves. And so in that moment, my mind is flooded with self-doubt. You're a failure. You're not going to do this. You're not good enough. You're not strong enough. You didn't train hard enough. And I stop those words going through my head and say, Colin, you are strong. You are capable. And every single day for the next 54 days, as my alarm went off, and every day was hard. It was 12 hours of pulling my sled. It was 5 hours of chores. My fingers are getting, you know, frostnip and frostbitten. I've got, you know, from the pictures, I'm starting to get frostbite on my cheek and my nose. I'm having to tape my face and I'm really falling apart. But I start every day before my mind can say anything by yelling out loud, Colin, you are strong. You are capable. And anyways, those are a couple of examples of the mental game. But basically, you know, sowing seeds and actually affirming the positive sides, you know, your mood follows that action.
I couldn't agree more. Like, this too shall pass. When I was in the Arctic, I tore my Achilles 86 kilometers from the end. I didn't realize until after it was torn, but I kept repeating, pain is temporary, this will pass. Pain is temporary, this will pass. Like, those positive words and mantras you repeat to yourself are so powerful. We spoke about the downsides and the bad, and there's what I love so much about the book, just to pull it back for people, is that you talk very clearly about these are all the struggles and downsides. These are how I processed it. This is how I got over it. Like, I don't want to say it's a self-help book, but it's a self-help book. Like, it's one of those that I'm like, when I read Arnold Schwarzenegger's Total Recall, I'm like, that's a book talking about a journey, someone's life journey. And in Colin's case, talking about his life and his journey through Antarctica. But I'm like, you're getting so much personal development and self-help through reading it, because your processes and way of handling things and dealing with difficult situations, I'm like, you can't not get an handful of tools that you can apply in your own life to run a 5K or run a half marathon or step foot in a gym or whatever it is that you have this fear loop going around in your mind. The book is going to help with that. So I just wanted to pull that back for people as well before we jump into some of the high points. You mentioned bliss and flow states. Was that something that, again, was there a single point? Because I don't want to say it's obviously towards the end, because that is, you're always going to feel that moment of relief and bliss towards the end. And I know you speak about this a little bit in the book, but was there any other high point during the duration of the run or during the duration of the sled pull crossing Antarctica that jumps out in your mind? Or was it just moments of dropping in and out of flow? What did that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, like you said, there's, like I said before, there's, you know, the angels and the demons or the super down moments, but there was a lot of really, really positive moments for sure. And my curiosity in going out in Antarctica, and I talk about this a little bit, and you know this from reading it, is I actually deleted almost all of my music. I left 5 albums, and there's a kind of funny story about that. But basically, to be in silence, to actually embrace the silence of Antarctica, you know, probably 97-98% of the time, I'm in complete silence and, of course, complete solitude, because Antarctica, 24 hours of daylight, there's really nothing to see, no wildlife, no mountains, no trees, nothing like that. Just like this endless white abyss, basically, with 24 hours of daylight. And so where does your mind, where does your body go in those moments? And obviously, we talked about some of the dark moments that it can go to in the midst of these intense circumstances. But also that stillness and the silence, and the reason I deleted almost all my content so I didn't have anything kind of distracting my brain, was to see what my mind could fill up in those spaces. Can I trigger flow state? I've triggered flow state in different ways as my athletic career, but could I get there in a deep and meaningful way that I'd never experienced before, even through deep meditation, even through this? What would that feel like? What would that be like? And there was lots of moments. And, you know, certainly as I went further in my journey, I got better and better at kind of triggering and tapping into that. But tapping into this kind of spaceless, timeless space in my body, where my body was just completely functioning the way it needed to. I was fueling myself. I was, you know, looking out on this endless whiteness. I was going back in my memories and revisiting things from my past in a beautiful way, you know, and that's why the book really loops back on that. You know, I would find these places in my mind, and this was wild being out there, where I could recall, you know, moments of my past with vivid detail. Like, I mean, like extreme vivid detail. So I might go back in my mind and say, oh my God, my first swim race when I was 5 years old. And it's not like I'm just like remembering that. I'm like, I'm completely there. You know, I'm diving into the swimming pool. I can feel the water on my face. I can see my mother on the other side of the pool holding a, you know, a orange towel at the end. I can see the kid next to me, what he's wearing, and the wind blowing across my face. I mean, every detail, as if I'm reliving it. And I could go back into these file folders in my brain of not just big moments in my life, but mundane moments, like driving to school on a random day when I'm 14 years old with my older sister, or, you know, walking in the park with my – whatever it was. And so these moments of complete flow, but also complete openness and, you know, sort of depth with all my life experiences all kind of correlating in my mind, and these visceral kind of, you know, almost like a lucid or vivid dream. It was absolutely fascinating and really amazing. And it leads me to believe that, you know, obviously in the normal day-to-day world, and I'm guilty of this with our phones and the internet and the news cycle and all these things, we're constantly distracted. But when you can get in that stillness, that solitude, that quiet reflection, you realize that it's all in there. All of the things, the people that we are a reflection of all these experiences we've had and all the component parts that make us up, and they're still in there, buried deep sometimes. But being able to access that was incredibly, incredibly blissful. And that was kind of taking my mind, you know, to a different place. But, you know, one other thing I'll say is, although the blank white landscape of Antarctica oftentimes was stark and disorienting and seemingly endless, there was something beautiful about being in such a pristine place. I mean, human footprints haven't touched most of that continent. It is completely preserved and pristine. I think there's one photo of it in the book, but this thing called a sun dog, which is basically a circular rainbow, appears on the sun sometimes when the ice crystals are reflecting off the light in a certain way. It's basically a big, huge circular rainbow around the sun. And so to experience some things like that all alone in the most pristine, untouched place in the world, you know, you're communing with nature in such an amazing way. Those were also some incredibly blissful and beautiful moments. And so, yes, there were hardships, but there was also tremendous beauty and joy and flow and peace and calm like I'd never felt ever before in my life.
Yeah, what comes to mind straight away is that the entire book is the journey of self-discovery through extreme suffering. Like, that's what jumps out at me on nearly every page, and every page when you're speaking about the Antarctica. And I love that message. I've got two more questions, because I could talk to you about all these other crazy things you've done, but we're going to focus on Antarctica for today. But I do have two more questions that I want to ask you. And one is, and I'm going to change this up for people who frequently listen to the podcast, because I normally ask people what advice they'd offer, say, their 18-year-old self. But I'm curious, Colin, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self, knowing what you know now and prior to the burns in Thailand? If you could go back, or somebody in a very similar position to you now that's 21, 22 prior to a life-changing event like 25% of your body being burned, what advice would you give yourself?
You know, it's an interesting question and one I have toiled with over time, not in the exact same way, but the question of would I tell myself, don't jump the rope, right? And as I've come back to that question various times, I'm going to answer the question in more totality, but I'm going to specifically go to the rope first, which is, although I wouldn't wish the pain and suffering that I felt on my worst enemy, I mean, it was just brutal. I have to realize at the same time going through that, and certainly the learning that my mother instilled in me on the process and the road to recovery of the power of the mind, of the power of shifting towards these powerful outcomes, it taught me my life's most important lesson. And so there's no doubt, and that's why the subtitle of my book, as I say, is From Fire to Ice, Crossing Antarctica Alone. Without the fire, without the darkness, there isn't the ice, there isn't the accomplishment, there isn't the, you know, understanding of myself, of the depth core to be able to achieve something like that many years into the future. And so I would have a hard time, even if I could, as painful as it would be to, you know, as an omniscient, you know, person transported back in a time machine to my 21-year-old self to watch myself jump that rope and all the pain that I know I'm going to go through, I realized that that pain actually had some value. And I talk about it in various different ways, but I believe that the high moments of accomplishment, the high moments of achievement, the, you know, if life is a spectrum of 1 to 10, the 10 out of 10 moments, they aren't in spite of the ones, in spite of the low moments, but they are because of them. I have been able to achieve so many things in my life because of the hardships I've overcome and learning on the other side. So I don't think I would tell my 21-year-old self not to jump the rope. But I would probably instill some other lessons, and you know, this is taking it in a slightly different direction. You know, one is certainly we can achieve anything when we set our minds to them. I'm a firm believer in that, and I would try to instill that. But I would also, this is a little bit less about achievement, but it's really about the, you know, ethics of or the ethos of what I learned out there on this journey, and you know this, is that to enjoy the journey, to enjoy the process, and really to embrace those other people around. And you know from reading the book, although this is a story about my personal journey walking across Antarctica by myself, when you interweave the backstories, what it really is a tapestry of all the people and all the love and all the support and all the different people in my life, from family to Jenna to all the other people in my life that have conspired to make this possible, Mike McCastle. And it's really to be kind to others, to appreciate the empathy, and really to uplift others in the process. I'm a big believer, the mission behind a lot of this was to share this with the world in a way that would inspire other people. And that's why the book, I didn't write it as a personal development book or self-help book, as you said, but I certainly didn't write it as a book to say, hey, look at me doing this amazing thing. It's that when we share our stories with the world, whether big or small, it could be in a book or it could just be across a dinner table with your friend, we have the power to not only strengthen ourselves, but to uplift others along the way. And so my 21-year-old self, I would try to instill that value even sooner to say, live your life to its fullest level, but share that with the world in a way that has a ripple effect of positivity out through the world. And that's the advice I give to any person anywhere. Like you mentioned, there might be a listener here, you know, thinking about running their first 5K. That is powerful. The day you tried to put on your shoes and you actually went for your first, you know, 1 mile run and then 2 miles, and then you accomplished a 5K, that is inspiring to somebody. That's inspiring to me. So share that. Share that and let the ripple effect of positivity uplift the community around you and around the world and making it a better place.
It's such an incredible message. And I'm one of those people that's been uplifted by your story even prior to reading the book, because when I came across you first, it was through the Joe Rogan podcast, I think, originally. It was because I was a couple of months out from the Arctic, and I followed your journey so closely since. And just, like, I had the book as soon as it went on pre-order. I'm like, it was my most anticipated book of the year. I'm like, I can't wait to read this. So I felt the most positive impact, or that positive impact of being uplifted from it. I have one last question, Colin. I'm not going to ask you what's next, because you've done things since Antarctica, and as someone that's always setting challenges for themselves that are to the height of the extreme, I'm not going to ask the question what's next, because I'm sure you get asked that 50 million times between DMs and podcasts and interviews, but I am going to ask you, what are you most excited about right now?
Good question. Well, I would be remiss to at least not give a 30 seconds on what I did recently finish, which was, as you know, from following along, since Antarctica, I went back to Antarctica in a different way, and I rowed a boat. Me and a team of five others, so six of us total, became the first people to ever row a boat completely human powered across Drake Passage. So from the southern tip of South America to Antarctica, 40-foot swells and waves and icebergs and insanity ensued in this tiny little rowboat. We did that 3 months ago, and if you followed on Instagram, you might have seen it, but there's a documentary coming out about it on Discovery later this year. So that's a whole other podcast. That was a wild, wild ride in itself. So that was quite a journey this year. But the question being, you know, what am I most excited about? You know, given the timeliness of what's happening in the world right now, you know, I was actually set to go climb Mount Everest this spring, April and May. As I mentioned, climbed it once before, but my wife had set the goal of climbing Everest. And so I was excited to go back with her, her first time in the Himalayas, and attempt Everest. And of course, with coronavirus, you know, COVID-19 happening in the world, that's canceled, as is most everything for most other people at the moment. You know, the world's going through a really tough time at the moment right now. And so, you know, I'll turn the answer to the question inward, which is, you know, I am a very goal-driven person. I am very, you know, like I said, turning that whiteboard into reality. I've got my whiteboard out now, even though I can't go to Everest. What's next? You know, what are we writing down? I do get that question, you know, tons and tons and times every single day. But I am also excited to take this opportunity when the world kind of feels like it needs to take a pause. And I understand the economic implications and the hardships that's, you know, that's causing for me, but certainly the hardships that's causing for millions and millions of people around the world who are sick or suffering, who are losing loved ones. You know, it's a very, very hard time in the world, but it's also an opportunity, to take a breath, maybe to take a moment of pause, to reflect, to really hammer home some of the really important values, whether that's around family, whether that's around community, whether that's around, you know, being able to connect with others deeper and further. And so I guess in this moment, I am anxious. I am fearful. I am, you know, I think the tragedy that's happening around the world is serious in a really significant way. And I'm staying at home. I'm doing all the social isolation, taking it all very seriously. But I do think that it's a moment to not waste, and whatever that looks like. And so I'm excited to take advantage in this moment of pause and that inner calm, and to strengthen the mind when I potentially can't be outside strengthening the body.
And to quote Colin, when it comes to COVID-19 and coronavirus, this too shall pass, I think is a very positive spin to put on a situation that isn't the most positive when you look at it as a whole, but taking it inward, this too will pass. COVID-19, coronavirus, and hopefully there's minimal deaths to loved ones. Again, it's something that can't be controlled, but it will pass and the world will go back to normal. Colin, I can't thank you enough for the book, for your message, for everything that you do, because by you leading your life the way you are, and, you know, for the lack of a better term, leading your best life, it just inspires the fuck out of me. Like, I can't not see what you're doing and not set myself bigger challenges and set myself bigger goals. So I can't thank you enough for that, and thank you enough for your time. Can you tell everybody listening where is the best place for them to pick up the book? And I will link those in the show notes. And where is the best place for people to reach out or connect with you or follow you online?
Yeah. So to reach out, connect to me, my website, Colin O'Brady, I do a lot of public speaking, all that, you know, you can find all about that there, about my nonprofit. That's all on my website, colinobrady.com, colinobrady.com. Then online, I'm on all the social platforms, but Instagram is probably my most active. So come say hello on me there, at Colin O'Brady. It's just my name. Shoot me a DM. I try to respond to as many folks as I can. Love it when people come over and say hello. So give a follow. come say hello on Instagram. And then for the book, yeah, everywhere online. If it's sold in bookstores, it's in the UK, it's in all the Commonwealth countries, it's getting translated into a number of languages in Europe as well. But if in the United States, any major bookstore, Amazon.com, both in the UK or in the US, so pretty much anywhere that you buy books, you know. And also there's an audiobook. I am the narrator of the audiobook. I record it myself. So Brian, I guess you probably recognize my voice already.
I love that. Like my little bit of a pet peeve, and I think Rogan has a similar pet peeve that he mentioned, when people don't read their own audiobook. So when I saw that it was you reading it, I'm like, please, because I saw the pre-order, I'm like, please say Colin's reading it. So that makes it even better. So I recommend people get both. Do what I did.
Exactly. So pick up the book or pick it up on audiobook, wherever you get your audiobooks. It's me reading it. The book's called The Impossible First, From Fire to Ice, Crossing Antarctica Alone. And yeah, Brian, thank you so much for an amazing interview. You inspire the heck out of me, man. So keep it up. Keep doing what you do, man. I really appreciate you. And thanks for taking the time today. It means a lot.
Oh, the pleasure was all mine. Colin, thank you so much again.
Whoa. Oh my goodness. I absolutely love that conversation, that podcast. One of my favorite books that I've read, one of my favorite audiobooks, now one of my favorite podcasts. Absolutely love this. I can't thank Colin enough for coming on. And hopefully you enjoyed it. If you've listened this far, you clearly enjoyed it as much as me. If you did, please take a screenshot of it and tag both me and Colin on your Instagram stories. And as always, if you're enjoying the podcast, please follow or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Podtail, Spotify, etc. And leave a rating and review if you're enjoying the podcast. This is one of these podcast episodes that I'm like, yeah, I'm totally going to ask for a rating and a review on this one, because if you got as much benefit from it as I did, hopefully it'll lead to a good rating. So yeah, it's totally selfish, but I'm totally asking. Anyways, that's everything from this week's podcast. Catch you all next week.